It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a program at the Wisconsin National Guard is working to strengthen troops' relationships with their loved ones when they deploy. We'll talk to the Wisconsin National Guard chaplain who runs that program. First, when it comes to higher education, the four-year colleges and universities often dominate the conversation. But over the last few years, that conversation has been changing. The increasing price of college, coupled with stagnating wages, has some families and students wondering if the return on a four-year college degree is worth it. But other options like community college and vocational schools don't always get a lot of respect. Community college leaders are looking to change that, and a social media campaign has members of Congress, business leaders, and others giving shout-outs to their community or technical college alma maters using the Twitter hashtag #EndCCStigma. Nicholas Hillman is an associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis for the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, do four-year campuses, the colleges and universities, kind of dominate our thinking, maybe of our policy conversations when it comes to higher education?
They certainly do. They certainly do, and they get outsized attention. If you were to add up all of the students who are enrolled in college across the U.S., 75% of them would be in a public university. So first of all, a lot of our attention gets placed on private colleges, but most students are in publics. And when you look at that 75%, you know, the public sector, about half are enrolled in community colleges. And so community colleges play a huge role in the higher education landscape, but get sort of, they don't get a lot of attention or a lot of positive attention.
Can you talk about the role that community colleges or technical colleges, they're called different things in different states, play in the higher education landscape?
These institutions are a backbone for communities. They are places where people who are oftentimes working full-time, caring for dependents, they have other responsibilities. They don't have time to just stop their lives and go, you know, move on campus at a traditional four-year college. And so community colleges are convenient, proximate places where a lot of people's educational needs can be very well served by their local community college. These institutions are also distinct because they're broad access. They're open access where pretty much anybody who applies gets admitted.
While we were talking about doing a show, a segment on this, and this has been out there on social media, talk about community college, this big scandal broke of wealthy people bending or breaking rules to get their kids into these elite institutions and campuses around the country. Is there, a social stigma, a social divide in the country that looks down on community colleges, even if it's not, or if it's on the radar at all?
I think there is. I think there is, and I think it cuts in so many different directions, but I'm really drawn to two of them that I just want to share that I think are helpful here. So the first one is that quality is just really, really hard to figure out what quality means in education, in higher education in particular. And so a lot of times we use shortcuts to kind of proxy quality, I suppose. And selectivity is oftentimes a proxy for quality. So the more selective of an institution you are, the higher quality it's perceived to be. And that's not always the case. And the other part is, if it's more expensive, then it must be higher quality. And again, that's not the case, not always the case. And so I think part of the problem here is just it's really hard to measure quality in any sort of objective way. But the other thing is that community colleges serve students who look the most like America. They serve students who oftentimes are your sort of your most average person. And in many ways, that's exactly the beauty of a community college. And I think there's some mystique or some mystery around selective colleges and how they draw people from oftentimes the top income thresholds that make it mysteriously appealing in some cases, at least in the media.
Talking to Nicholas Hillman, associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison, looking at the role of community colleges and technical colleges in the country. There's an active campaign by community college leaders to say, hey, more respect, less stigma about these colleges. Nicholas, there are a couple different roles, it seems like. People might think of the vocational track. You get a certification via a technical college that leads you to one job. But there's also a big general education component that people might stop at their community or technical college, or they might take 2 years there and then move on to that four-year college.
That's right. And every state has a different approach. Every state has a different kind of system through which students sort of flow within higher education. Here in Wisconsin, we tilt very heavy on the vocational side of the house. And so I know that there's a lot of interest with respect to improving that transfer pipeline between the two-year, the technical college sector, and the four-year sector. And so every state is challenged with this kind of coordination, but I think Wisconsin is uniquely challenged because our tech college system is probably more vocational than you might find in some other places.
Now, on the Ideas Network Facebook page, we heard from Carol, who wrote, "My daughter attended a two-year UW school. It was less expensive than a four-year school, helped her figure out what she wanted a degree in, and then transferring to a four-year school was easy." So that might point toward a unique element here in Wisconsin. We have the technical colleges, we have the four-year campuses, we also have these two-year UW system campuses that have now been merged with partner four-year schools. We kind of have that middle ground.
That's right. The University of Wisconsin Colleges did play that middle ground, and it's going to be very interesting just to see how their new evolution changes. But I think it's also helpful context to know that the UW colleges, when you sort of add up everybody across the state, they accounted for a very small share of the total number of students who are in the two-year colleges. So we still are dominated by the tech college system. And in many ways, that's wonderful for communities. But in other ways, it can create some challenges when it comes to having a pipeline between the two- and four-year sector in the state.
There's a debate in higher education in general, it seems like, and I think we've probably talked about it some, Nick, over the last couple of years. Is higher education meant for job preparation, whether we're talking about a technical college or a four-year campus, or is it doing something else? Is it supposed to create a well-versed group of citizens in the country? Can technical colleges and community colleges do some of both of those?
Yes, I mean, that's really the fundamental question that is always going to be answered over time and changes over time. But just like every individual is going to have different educational needs, institutions have different missions to serve their own local needs. And so I think that part of the challenge is that these are going to evolve, and they're also very much varied with respect to the educational mission and purposes. But certainly, I mean, people want to be better off financially, but they also want to leave their communities better off with their investment. And I get really excited when I think about somebody who's investing in their own education. I oftentimes benefit from them investing in themselves. And so to think about colleges, not just in terms of your personal payoff, but also how having more people with more formal education can benefit a community is really, really exciting. And I think it cuts across two-year, four-year vocational, liberal arts. It cuts across all of those sectors, but probably in vocational education doesn't get as much attention as it deserves. A lot of times where these vocational programs are training people to be even better problem solvers, and I want my neighbors to be good problem solvers.
A lot of times when we have a conversation about higher education, I think, well, my mind goes to the high school senior. They graduate, and then they go on, if they go on to higher education, to community college or the four-year campus. Can you talk about the role that technical and community colleges play for maybe people all through their lives, different stages of life?
Yeah, that's right. So community colleges, technical colleges, as I mentioned earlier, generally are open access, broad access institutions. And so students who are enrolling are oftentimes enrolling part-time. They might be coming for one or two classes. They might not have the plan to, transfer. They might already have a degree. They might already have a bachelor's degree and said, hey, I want to just retool and go back into a different, job. And so they come into the classroom with a degree under their belts. And so you see a whole range. A lot of areas around the state are really concerned about the number of high school graduates that are even in the pipeline. It's kind of flattening out in a lot of places, and in some places even declining. And so people are really interested in, well, hey, where are we going to find more students to enroll? And they're looking at the adult population who maybe is 25 years or older, who has maybe some college but no degree. And in many communities, that's where your demographic growth is happening. And so community colleges are being responsive in those ways. And in fact, more responsive than some of our public institutions, not just in Wisconsin, but across the country.
We're talking to Nicholas Hillman right now, associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis for the UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about community and technical colleges. There's a nationwide effort to boost some respect for those schools and what some leaders see as a stigma toward technical and community colleges. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you went to a community college or technical school or trade school, depending on where you were in the country, what was your experience like? Did you feel pressure to go to a four-year school? We want to hear your story. And we're seeing this online campaign of people giving shout-outs to their community college alma maters. Do you want to do that? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're taking a look at higher education options for students and ongoing efforts to boost options like community colleges and vocational schools. Nicholas Hillman is with us, associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis for the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you went to a community college or technical college, what was your experience like? Were you glad you did it? Do you work in one of those schools, maybe around the state? We'd love to hear from you as well. Or if you have a question for our guest, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A lot of people sharing their experiences there. We'll go to your calls now. Phyllis is with us in Clark County. Phyllis, hello.
Hi. I just would like to tell you that I'm eternally grateful for the community college in Wood County, Marshfield, Wisconsin. I started school there when I was 27 years old. My husband was a dairy farmer. I never would have had the opportunity to go to school had that school not been there. No, this is history, folks, because I'm 80 years old. But then I commuted. It took me 3 years to do two. And then I went to Eau Claire, to the university, and ultimately to Stout. And the fact that those institutions were relatively local, 30 miles to Marshfield, 60 miles to Eau Claire, 90 miles to Stout. And I just can't say enough, but the community college was so good. The instructors were so available. I raised my grade point about 0.4 of a point when I went to Eau Claire, basically because I was so coming out of the small school.
All right, Phyllis.
Then I also, as a working person, went to Chippewa Valley, and that was outreach in Spencer, Wisconsin, where I took courses in technology. And my husband accomplished a production ag 2-year degree from Chippewa Valley under the GI Bill.
Wow. So again, Phyllis, I'm going to jump in, but a lot of experience there with her family. Nick, one thing she said up front there was if it weren't for that technical college about 30 miles away, she would not have gone to college probably at all.
I'm drawn to that. I'm drawn to the distance part and the access part. The access part we've discussed, and that's just a wonderful, wonderful example of what post-secondary education can do. And when the states invest in education to make those opportunities widely available is wonderful. But I'm also drawn to the 30-mile radius. Most students, probably about half of the students around the country, enroll in a college that's within 50 miles from home, even closer, especially when you get into the community college and technical college system. And so I think that's just a point that cannot go understated. We might have in our minds this image from movies of students, you know, flying across the country to go live, you know, far, far away for college. But the reality is, you know, people choose colleges in their own backyard and close to home. And there's so much beauty in that. And I think there's a lot of emphasis that we need to place on local context in higher education that we oftentimes overlook.
Phyllis, thanks a lot for sharing your story and your husband's story. We'll go now with Delia in Three Lakes. Delia, hi.
Hello, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what did you want to share with us, Delia?
I just want to give a shout out to Nicolet Area Technical College in Rylander, Wisconsin. I graduated there with my associate degree in nursing and absolutely loved the college. the professors, and I think they prepared me for a good nursing career.
And so you went on to work in nursing?
Yes, correct. Yep. So after graduating UCLA, I actually obtained my bachelor's degree, and then I went to getting my master's degree in nursing with an emphasis on education.
Delia, thank you so much for sharing your story. And Nick, we heard stories from people on the Ideas Network Facebook page talking about, you know, getting a technological degree, and then getting a job, and then working through for a four-year engineering degree. Is this a common career path? You get that two-year certificate, get a job, and then maybe work your way through higher education beyond that?
It's increasingly common, and our system of community colleges was really developed and thrived early on in the 60s and 70s. And so we're still kind of in the early phase in many ways with respect to what the evolution of the community college sector might look like. But this is increasingly a pathway that is best for a lot of people, for convenience and time and proximity, but also for affordability. There's some interesting questions that I've been surprised we haven't been able to answer quite yet with respect to whether or not you have less student loan debt by going through this pathway. In some cases, you would think, sure, you would graduate with less debt if you start off at a two-year and go to a four-year. But there's also some cases where, you know, the process might slow you down. It might kind of not be as smooth as it could be, and that can actually increase the time to degree and increase some of your expenses. So we're trying to figure this out as a research community, not just in terms of the pathway that people take, but also the financial consequences and implications of different pathways.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Nicholas Hillman from the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison, looking at the role of technical colleges and community colleges as options in our higher education system. Back to your calls now. Kent is with us in Reedstown. Kent, hi.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I went to relocated from California. I went to a piano technology tech school in Sioux City, Iowa. And it was probably the best year of any kind of education that I ever got.
All right. Are you a piano tech still, Kent?
Well, I'm retired pretty much, but I did it 30-some years.
Wow.
So.
Well, I'm sitting about 12 feet from a piano in our relocated studio right now. Maybe we'll have you take a look at it. Kent, thanks a lot for calling in. Nick, that's a very specific career track, and that's one of the options out there in technical colleges.
That's right. In programs around the country, you might have a certificate, a short-term certificate that maybe takes a few months or several months to complete, a longer-term certificate. You could go to the associate's degree, too. I mean, there's a whole range of different credentials that are available for people in technical and community colleges. And across the board, there are, on average, positive financial returns to those investments. So the associate's degree, on average, tends to have the biggest payoff in the long run. But even for the shorter-term credentials, you oftentimes see a boost over having a high school diploma, for example. And so that payoff is there. There's a lot of variation around it, though. And a lot of times industries do change and people do need to kind of retool a number of different times. But yeah, I think on average, that's a national story that is emerging with community college and the payoff of that investment.
Kent, thanks a lot for that call. Nick, we've heard some individual stories, and it's clear people are coming from a lot of different places. These schools, technical colleges and community colleges, are being asked to perform a lot of different functions. The policy side of things, what do you make of how states and the federal government are supporting and crafting their community college programs?
The national attention on community colleges has faded away a little bit over the last couple of years because during the Obama administration, they really were pushing some initiatives that were designed to invest in community colleges. We haven't seen that as much lately. I think one policy issue that is still on the table and not resolved relates to student loan debt and student loan default. And so when you look across the country at where most of the student loan defaults are happening, and this is when a student takes out a loan and then just doesn't pay it off for, you know, several months in a row and they end up going in default. That's concentrated among for-profit colleges, which is separate from what we're discussing. But there is a pretty big pocket of community colleges that are struggling with this student loan default problem. And so that's one of the federal issues that people are very interested in, is trying to figure out ways to help support community colleges in ways so that students don't struggle with their debts, even though sometimes those debts are pretty modest. Sometimes students are still struggling with them.
There are overall concerns about support for higher education at the state and federal level. Within that, is there any kind of I guess, turf war between four-year campuses and technical colleges?
There is, and I'm not talking specifically in Wisconsin. Again, broadly, there's sometimes discussions that community colleges need to stay in their lane. They need to only offer the associate's degree and nothing higher. They should not be offering a bachelor's degree. Well, in Wyoming, just today, I was reading a story about how a lot of their community colleges are now allowed to start offering a bachelor's degree. And for the state of Wyoming, that's probably a really good thing because they're right. The community colleges are located in the population centers around the state. And so just kind of grow what you already have as opposed to starting something new or expecting people to move across the state. So a number of states have had this kind of debate about mission creep, whether or not community colleges should even consider offering a bachelor's degree. I would argue that in many cases, it's probably a good thing for community colleges to expand their academic mission if that's what the state and the region need.
And on the other end of things, getting back to the vocational side, we hear talk of particular employers working directly with technical colleges, Foxconn being one example of that. Is there opportunity to improve the way that technical colleges meet very specific needs of existing employers?
I think so. This is a little bit outside of my expertise, but I am thinking of a couple of examples from other states where you're trying to get people through the pipeline more quickly so that they can be ready to hop into those jobs when those jobs open up. And so there's a temptation sometimes to automate the community college experience by putting a lot of courses online. I know California is moving this direction. And I think in some cases there could be upside to that. But I think at the same time, the research is pretty clear that moving courses online without extra supports and infrastructure, and especially that face-to-face contact, can work against some of those goals. So it's a striking this balance between, you know, being responsive and being innovative, but also delivering high quality.
Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, Rob, it's my pleasure. You take care and good luck with the where you are.
Yeah, we're in the midst of a move right now. Nicholas Hillman was with us, associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis for the UW-Madison. He joined us today to talk about higher education and why working to reduce the stigma of community college and vocational schools might help a broader group of students. Coming up after the news, we'll hear about a program that's trying to relieve some of the stress on families and loved ones of members of Wisconsin's National Guard. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Kohler Company's plans for what it calls a world-class golf course in Sheboygan County are in doubt. We'll look at a ruling from a state judge and where the project goes from here. First, military deployments can create stress for service members and their families. Long periods of separation can be part of the problem, along with the risks and possible trauma that can be part of a deployment. Our next guest wants families and individuals in Wisconsin's National Guard to be more prepared for those stresses. To do that, he helps run a relationship-strengthening retreat for Guard members called the Strong Bonds Program. Doug Hedman is the state chaplain of the Wisconsin National Guard and administrator for the Guard's Strong Bonds Program. Chaplain Hedman, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Yeah, it's great to be invited and to share the wonderful programs that we're offering for the Guard members.
Well, I talked about it very briefly there. Can you talk about some of the stresses you see when Guard members are deployed, in some cases overseas?
Well, probably the biggest stressor is just the separation. And, you know, if they're married, the spouses have to take on a lot of additional responsibilities. And obviously the soldier, they've got to be focused on the mission. And when they're separated for that long, when they come back together, you need something to bind them back together. And we found the Strong Bonds is just an excellent resource for the families and soldiers.
And the philosophy, if I'm reading this right, isn't let's wait for the problems to happen and help the couple or the family deal with them then. You want to get out ahead of this.
Absolutely. What I always tell couples is it's really maintenance on your relationship. It's like with your car, you bring it in, you get it tuned up, you change the oil, and you're good to go for another 100,000 miles.
And for, say, a couple who's getting ready for one of them to be deployed far away, in a lot of ways, they don't know what's coming, right? They don't know what those stresses are going to feel like.
Right, right. So what's really neat about the Strong Bonds program is when we bring couples together, they're in a mix with some people that have already been deployed versus first-time deployers, and just that crosstalk is very helpful and comforting.
Well, take us on a visit to the Strong Bonds retreat.
Well, what we do is absolutely everything is free. So we go to very nice places, usually resort areas. Everybody wears civilian clothes, so it doesn't have that military feel. But we bring everybody in on a Friday night. We feed them. We normally do a little bit of programming. And then on Saturday, we get them up, and we go until 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and then we're done. And then we let them enjoy the nice area. And then Sunday, we wrap up, and we're done by noon. But probably the most important thing is we work on all kinds of relationship skills, like communication. You know, we talk about finances, how to work through issues that they might be having. And we just set the stage for good, positive communication. And obviously, if the couple goes to the program before deployment, it's really great. But then when they come back, it's even better because they've already had a little bit of an experience, but now they get the full meal deal, so to speak, when they come back.
Let's talk about some of those different angles, and communication seems like it's going to be a really important one. What kind of messages do you have for people getting ready for that separation? And I guess this could be true for anybody getting into a long-distance relationship, not just Guard or military members. What are some of the keys to communication at a distance like this?
Probably the biggest thing is communicating every day, if possible. And it can just be the small stuff, just to know what's been going on in each person's life. Obviously, if they're on deployment, there's probably stuff that they cannot say, but they can talk about the kids and talk about the family and, you know, be counting the days down until they're reunited again. And then if there is issues, there's resources on both sides back at the States. So they can talk about, hey, check out these people for help, or obviously, if they're deployed, they can talk with chaplains or behavior health specialists, you know, to kind of help people get through.
And this is an amazing thing now. I think if you go back just, 20 years ago, service members and their families communicating every day, you know, maybe they're on a base with one payphone that you stand in line for forever. The opportunities for that communication are a lot bigger than they used to be.
Oh, absolutely. People bring their cell phones or their tablets and they're communicating all the time. So it's terrific.
And that idea of communicating every day, I imagine if you don't, and if it's once every 2 weeks, once every month, that's a lot of pressure on that conversation.
Oh, absolutely. And I just want to highlight something. So when we do strong bonds, we do strong bonds for single service members, for couples, and for families. And when I was deployed, I would get like an email from maybe a parent of a single soldier, and the single soldier hadn't communicated back with their parents, so my job was to go, hey, call home.
Right. Talk a little more about the single service members who are going through strong bonds. What kind of messages do you have for them?
A lot of it is communication. It's really a lot of self-awareness, kind of your personality type. It's kind of integrating with different people. And then we teach them that you really need to take time in a relationship. Let it develop. Don't rush into anything. You know, you always hear about the couples that they get the deployment notice and boom, they want to get married right away. And we discourage that because we go, you know, I think you need to have a little bit more time to get to know the other person, and you need to know a little bit more about yourself too.
Talking to Wisconsin National Guard Chaplain Doug Hedman about the State National Guard's Strong Bonds program for National Guard service members before, or in some cases, as we're hearing, after deployment. Chaplain Hedman, you mentioned something that I hadn't thought of a few minutes ago, finances. And this is probably getting back more to the couples, the family members. There are a lot of couples out there where one is in charge of the, you know, the bank stuff and things like that. How do you talk to couples about that before deployments?
we address it as an issue and or a something that who's going to manage the money when you're gone and how to handle it. And if they're kind of struggling, then one of the things that we do is we refer them on to, we have financial folks that are free that can sit down with the couple before, during, or after their deployment to get their books in order. So we just touch on it. And then another program that I offer is I do the Dave Ramsey program, which is awesome. I do a retreat on a weekend, and it's amazing how many people take that and they're debt-free in about a year.
Did you see yourself going into that kind of financial counseling when you went into the chaplain line of work?
No, I did not.
I didn't expect it, yeah.
No.
Now, what do you hear from graduates of the Strong Bonds program?
You know, they just love the program. And usually if I get them to go to one Strong Bonds weekend, I got them hooked. And they'll be repeats. And I've had people make comments that, you know, this really saved our marriage. Or I've had other people that have said, you know, this is just exactly what we needed. You know, we were kind of struggling in our relationship. And just this weekend away where we could focus on us as a couple or a family, it really has made a difference.
Now, this is preventive maintenance, Strong Bonds, you were saying earlier. What kind of services are out there for someone maybe post-deployment and they're having trouble maybe getting back into civilian life in their marriage or that relationship with their family?
So what we do, and we've had couples like that, they're really struggling. So what we'll do is we'll hook them up with a behavior health specialist if that's needed, or we'll hook them up with a local clergy. And sometimes our chaplains will take them on for, you know, some initial counseling to get them back on track.
What does it mean to have, I think I've seen the phrase ready family in some of your materials. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things about the National Guard is we got to be ready at any time for any mission, and it can be foreign or domestic. And so we want our families to be prepared. And again, Strong Bonds is one of these programs where we get them together and we work through a lot of things. So when the call comes, they're ready.
So if there's a guard, a service member out there or a family or their family member listening right now, and they're thinking, well, we haven't done this. We want to be ready in case of a deployment. How do they get in?
You simply Google strongbonds.org, and then you look for Wisconsin. And we've got several programs that they can still sign up for. And if they can't get in this year, because we're kind of getting towards the end of our fiscal year, we're going to have a whole host of them for next year.
And you could see how this would benefit Guard members and their families. Do you think this has a positive impact on Guard readiness, unit readiness here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. In my opinion, this is like one of the best programs that the National Guard offers for families or for soldiers, because it's really a civilian, so it's a citizen thing, even though they're soldiers, and it's free. And everyone that has gone, they really love it.
Is this something that maybe other states are looking at what we're doing here in Wisconsin and saying, hey, Chaplain Hedman, how can we do that over here?
Yep. So other states, same thing. They go on the Strong Bond website, look at their particular state and see what they're offering. And I'm going to brag about Wisconsin. We've always had a really robust program. So we're always, if we can put extra weekends in there, we're going to do it because we want to serve our citizen soldiers well here in Wisconsin.
As we wrap up, and this, you've been at this for a while, what are some of the more recent additions or innovations that you think are making a difference with Strong Bonds?
Well, one of the things is we do not offer the same programs every year. We have repeats, but we'll add new programs. Like now back online again is Laugh Your Way to a Better Marriage. We have the Speed of Trust. We've done 8 Habits of Highly Effective Families, which is a Covey thing. So we're always innovating, and we're trying out new places and new things.
Chaplain Hedman, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks for inviting me.
That's Doug Hedman, State Chaplain of the Wisconsin National Guard. He was with us to talk about the Guard's Strong Bonds program, which builds relationship skills for Wisconsin National Guard service members and their loved ones. Coming up, a judge rejected a DNR permit for a high-end golf course along Lake Michigan. We'll find out what that means for the region, the environment, and the local economy. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the role of social media companies in radicalization online after the mass shooting in New Zealand. First, plans for a luxurious golf course in Sheboygan County are up in the air after a ruling by a state administrative judge. The Kohler Company was planning on building the project along Lake Michigan next to Kohler-André State Park. But yesterday, the judge struck down an environmental permit that was granted to the company by the state's Department of Natural Resources. So what now? Sarah Weitz-Kotacek is an environmental reporter with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She's also the Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow here at WPR. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Well, we talked with you last fall about this golf course proposal. Before we get into this new ruling from a judge, remind us what all is involved here in this proposed project.
The plan is to build a 18-hole public golf course on land owned by Kohler on the shores of Lake Michigan. That would involve tearing down or cutting down about half of the trees on the property, building a maintenance building and a clubhouse, and restructuring the landscape around some rare wetlands and dunes to build a golf course.
And those changes, those environmental changes, are why this has been met with protests and some lawsuits, right?
Yeah, these wetlands are particularly rare in Wisconsin, and scientists for the Department of Natural Resources found that they're actually globally rare. There are federally endangered plants and federally endangered birds that use the land as a stopover point for migration. So there was found to be a pretty significant level of environmental damage that would come from both the restructuring of the landscape, tearing down the trees, as well as the fertilization of the golf course, which there's a concern that the chemicals would seep directly into the groundwater and destroy the dunes.
The DNR, though, despite those concerns, did sign off on this plan, allowing Kohler to recover or create wetlands elsewhere in different sites. But you reported last time we talked to you that there's concern about the DNR approval process.
Several of the scientists that we spoke with who had worked for the department at that time said that there was pressure from the administration to approve the permit no matter what. And the permit, while it found these detrimental effects from the project, was ultimately approved, which longstanding DNR staff said, you know, is really unusual. In the past, when scientists found that a project didn't meet state standards and undermine the protections laid out in state law, that it wouldn't be approved.
And on the other side, people were pointing toward the possible economic impact and the benefits this would bring. Again, before we get to the court ruling, what were people hopeful for with the economic impact of this plan?
The project promises to bring millions of dollars in revenue to the county and create jobs. Kohler is one of the primary employers in the Sheboygan area. There are already several golf courses, and of course, Kohler's resort and is one of the major employers in town and is, you know, also a significant philanthropist in that area. So, of course, on the business side, there was much hope for the project to be a stimulus for the area.
We're talking to Sarah Weitz-Kotacek with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and WPR, looking at a court ruling on Kohler's proposed golf course, new golf course in northeastern Wisconsin. Let's get to this lawsuit now. First of all, who had brought the suit trying to, I guess, overturn this DNR permit, Sarah?
A conservancy group called the Friends of the Black River brought the lawsuit, brought several lawsuits on various courts, as well as this petition to the administrative law judge to stop the project.
So this administrative judge, Mark Kaiser, rejected now the permit that the DNR had awarded to Kohler, the permit we were just talking about. What were his reasons? What were his explanations for doing that?
He rejected the permit because the DNR, he said, did not have enough information to know whether this project would harm the wetlands and to what extent, because they didn't collect ample information about the chemical seepage into the groundwater. And also there was no mitigation plan for the damage that would be done to the wetlands and the bird habitat and various other environmental priorities for that land.
So the idea there is then the DNR said, okay, Kohler will handle these problems, but didn't have a specific plan from Kohler as to how they were going to do that. Do I have that right?
I think the biggest concern is that the DNR just was supposed to know for sure what the effects of the project would be and to know whether it would meet state standards for protecting wetlands, water quality, and the environment. But there wasn't enough information for the department to be sure, according to the judge, that they really were protecting those environmental assets. And he also said that, you know, there was no mitigation plan for some of the damages that were going to occur, most certainly to wildlife habitat and other aspects of the project. There was a plan to mitigate some of the wetland loss, but that wasn't complete, he said.
So what does that mean for Kohler now if they presumably want to proceed with this project? What do they do next?
Well, Kohler says they're planning to appeal. They can take this through the courts. And in a similar instance, in a similar ruling last year, a judge blocked a wetland permit for a sand processing facility. And then the Department of Natural Resources, then secretary, actually opted to review that decision, which is an unusual step. The secretary has now been replaced under Tony Evers, and perhaps it's less likely that that review would be done on this project, but it is another avenue that the decision could be overturned.
So potentially, if Kohler's appeal fails, they would have to go back to the drawing board and start again on a new approval process with the DNR, and if they wanted to move ahead?
Yes, that's right. And, you know, it's speculative, of course, but it seems like from the judge's ruling that it would be very difficult on this site to create a project that could be the kind of world-class golf course that Kohler is hoping to build and also meet the environmental standards laid out by the law.
We'll leave it there and keep watching the story. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, environmental reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She's also the Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow at Wisconsin Public Radio. We talked to her about a state judge's decision that blocks the Kohler Company from building a high-end golf course along Lake Michigan in Sheboygan County, the judge rejecting a permit approval from the state DNR. The Kohler Company says it plans to appeal that decision. You can read more about this story, Sarah's reporting on the current state of affairs, the judge's ruling, and past reporting on the ongoing controversy over this proposed golf course. You can find that all at WPR.org. And while you're there, you can weigh in with your thoughts. Is this golf course something that the northeastern Wisconsin economy needs? Do you think that the environmental costs outweigh the economic benefit? Is there a way that you could see this project working out for everybody? And we'd especially like to hear from you if you live in that part of the state. Are people talking about this? What are you hearing from people in your neighborhood when it comes to this judge's decision to reject the DNR permit? You can let us know in the comments on the story at WPR.org. You can email ideas@WPR.org. And as always, you can join us via social media outlets. Tweet us, for example, at Central Time WPR, and let us know what you think. One side effect of running for president, you have to eat a lot of regional foods and you will be judged for your choices. The latest case in point was here in Wisconsin. Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke of Texas came here to the state to talk, and he went to Culver's for a burger, fries, and custard, leading some critics to ask where were the fried cheese curds. And some people responded the burger and custard were Wisconsin enough. Then there was a debate about where to go for good fried curds. Now, of course, this is all not really part of why you should vote for or against a candidate. But I think about this during presidential seasons. Among the many reasons I would be a terrible presidential candidate, I think I would just get sick of eating all the foods, because a lot of these regional foods are sometimes foods, and you got to eat them all the time. You know, the Iowa State Fair foods, deep fried blank on a stick, you'd be eating every day. I had the Philly cheesesteak when you're campaigning in Philadelphia, Memphis barbecue, all good foods. But if you have a, you know, a bit of the reflux, like some of us do, that would get really overwhelming. Sometimes you just, you know, if you think about it, when you're on a vacation and you eat restaurant food all the time, sometimes you just want something really simple, like a bowl of cereal. But do that, and you're all over the media rejecting the food of the people of that state. So good luck, presidential candidates, and take plenty of the Tums with you. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.